have a bit of a think about questions that you'd like to ask. I'm going to kick off with a couple of questions for Nigel. One of the issues around attracting more people, I guess, to South Australia, and the question that I always have around movements across populations is this a bit of a chicken and egg situation in terms of what comes first, the investment or the skilled workforce, or it's actually a lot more complicated than that in terms of the timing of building up each of these things. How do you see that from a business perspective, and what role do you think business in conjunction with government and other stakeholders has for kind of getting that all in the right order to grow population?
That's a great question, Jared, because one that I don't know the answer to. Is it population first, then jobs? Is it jobs, then population? Is it investment, then jobs, then population? Somehow I think it all comes together. It's really interesting. I wrote an article the other day for The Advertiser. We have a regular column where we had two kinds of confidence in the state. One was one that we kind of told ourselves we were great. And, you know, there was a lot of kind of hype about talking ourselves up. And then in the last kind of, probably the last year or so, and I've got to give credit to the last government because a lot of those initiatives started to come through. The new government came in. There's a genuine confidence now. So you can't sort of beat confidence into people. It's visceral. It's there. It's real. We've run the longest running survey of business confidence in the state's history, I think 40 years, that we're at the highest level of confidence. And that confidence has come, I think, because there's been a combination of some things. One, our visitor economy is on fire, international education, tourism, events, and so on and so forth. We're slated for hundreds of billions of dollars worth of investment, whether it be defence, mining, you know, the airport expanding with a $1 billion expansion. So it feels like we've come of age. It feels like the world's kind of discovered Adelaide and South Australia. And typically you'd say, well, people aren't going to come back. And there's two kinds of population we're looking for. It's expat South Australians who've gone, who desperately, when I was chair of SA Great, we used to go travel interstate and they go, we'll come back tomorrow to be with mum and dad because we want free babysitters. So if you can get me, you know, any kind of job, I'll take a cut in pay. And so there's a whole kind of expat community we want to get back. And then there's, of course, the international community. The one thing that we shouldn't do is try and impress people from Melbourne, Sydney, Perth, or anywhere else that this is the place to move. We've got an opportunity, I think, that's quite unique to get expat South Australians back and to get international migration of the right kind, the skills kind, in. But right now we're hearing that a number of these, and I'm not directly answering your question, I know, because I don't know about chicken and the egg, so I'll leave that one with you. I'll leave that one with the experts. But what we're hearing is the people who are coming, maybe it's the Gupta group, or maybe it's Naval group, or Naval group, or any of these, they're not concerned about the fact that they're going to bring investment. They're concerned that we won't have the population to support it. So before it used to be, sure, we can get population here, but what are they going to do? Now we've actually flipped it in quite a short time. We've got a huge amount of projects, and our risk is that we won't have population and skills to support it. So it's been, I think it's been actually pretty rapid in the last few years where we, so I came here about 18 years ago. 18 years ago, we had a real problem. We didn't have the jobs. We didn't have the investment. We would have been really saying to people, we'll come back, but, you know, good luck with the job. It's almost flipped completely 180. And I think we do have the jobs. We do have the investment. We have the opportunities. They are now at risk because we're not getting the people back.
Okay. So given all of that, what are your thoughts on a few of the policy proposals and speculation that seem to be floating around at the moment around whether it's regional settlement or states setting migration targets?
Yep.
What's your thoughts on that?
Look, we're strongly in favour of an all of country holistic approach and recognising that you can't set, as I mentioned before, population policy for Melbourne, Sydney and Southeast Queensland. We would absolutely welcome an approach from, Scott Morrison to actually start diverting about 45%, roughly, I think that's what they were talking about, of our inbound migrants outside of major cities, so to regional cities. Now, some years ago, we spoke about Adelaide having that status again, and we accept that every secondary city and every regional economy should have the same status. So we're happy to, you know, compete with Hobart or Wagga or Ballarat. But the concept of actually asking people to come to a what is regarded as regional Australia, which is Adelaide, is a very powerful one. We've got to start there. So, I mean, let me just give you an anecdote. I was in Whyalla. Whyalla's been through a very difficult time. Sanjeev Gupta's come in with, you know, several billion dollars worth of investment. One of the things that they said to me was that they have three generations of Filipino migrants who've built this community that is so important to them. We know that if you get people to Adelaide, I'm just picking Adelaide for a moment, and they're here for, say, 5 years, it's very rare for them to go. And the whole concept of the self-fulfilling prophecy, so why do people go from overseas go to Sydney and Melbourne? Because they know people in Sydney and Melbourne. They have relatives in Sydney and Melbourne. Why? Because for generations, their relatives have gone to Sydney and Melbourne. And there are cultures that have been created. And so the concept of, and we're only taking about at best 45% of those migrants and saying you've got to live outside a mega city, but those people will find a lifestyle and a quality of life that will probably keep them there, depending on where they go. So to answer your question, we're heavily in favour of a rebalancing of the dysfunction that we're seeing around mega cities. What we're seeing is in other, I think you mentioned it before, in the US, that you favour certain cities. I mean, we're not going to send people, you know, to some tin shed in the middle of the desert and say, there's your new home, you know, congratulations. I think we need to back some winners federally, and you go to cities that you know, like Adelaide, which have the investment, which have the opportunities, and you steer people there. And, you know, sometimes I think of the early days of Singapore when they were broke and impoverished in the 60s. The government moved in, and there are times for government to intervene to actually structure an economic future, and this is one of those pivotal times.
All right. Well, I might open it up to the floor at that point. Got a question here and then here.
Financial institutions, you know, had a fair role to play in the GFC, and obviously something's played out the Royal Commission. And it's more the behaviour of the financial institutions, and what often happens, it's the customers that have to pay the price. And at the moment, the customers are having to pay the price, particularly investors, where responsible lending is now being implemented. So we're going to have, potentially, for the first time, usually it's developers that find it hard to get funds. Now it's the investors that are going to find it difficult to get the funds. And, you know, there's a potential double effect on housing from that lack of investment, but also for the supply of housing. Just wanted, hopefully what I've said makes sense.
But, yep. No, I mean, I see the housing market as a little bit of a mixed bag at the moment. I note today there was a headline around perhaps we've been haven't been concerned enough about what the impact of the crackdown on interest-only loans will be, and what the impact of that will be. The small kind of silver lining at the moment with prices coming down is actually more first home buyers are getting into the market, which is actually a positive amidst. More first home buyers are getting into the market, particularly in the bigger cities. But certainly it's a watch point, and I mean, I talked about the financial vulnerabilities, and we do have a situation in this country where rentals are owned by individuals, and that does mean that we have a high level of debt to income. And so I do think that's something that we've always got to be monitoring and be careful about. Because it does present a risk particularly where there's an external shock. And often these things, as we've seen in the past, they materialise very quickly. And so before you know it, there is an issue where economists were saying there wasn't, you know, only a few months ago.
But so that maybe goes back to the financial institution that was loaning that money more than the people. Apparently, you know, people like me, I'm no longer a responsible investor. And my, you know, I ask a question of a bank, hypothetical, of course. If I had $10 million and no income, you wouldn't loan me a dollar. And you said that is correct. Which, you know,
yep.
Sort of not going to that extreme, but to another extreme. You know, I think they've gone too far, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Sorry.
You go.
Look, I think it's going to be a bit of a pincer effect. So we've had the Royal Commission come through. The banks have been, you know, correctly exposed for some bad practices. But the flow on of that is exactly what you're saying, a change in credit policy. Now, how do you build wealth in places like Melbourne and Sydney and, in fact, here? You take a mortgage that's far too big, you pay interest only, and in 2 or 3 years, you, with capital gains tax-free, you flip it and you get to your next, you know, interest only. We've grown, you know, everybody really, well, so many people in places like Sydney and Melbourne have to be property speculators on their own home, because that's the only way you can get to the point where you can own it one day, and you have to pay these interest only things and flip it. If now with the self-flagellation the banks are going through, they start tightening up credit, and they are trying to unwind years of people having had a certain approach to the way that you invest. There is a worry with our colleague organisation, the MBA, about the proposal from a shortened federal government about negative gearing and what that will do to construction, what it'll do to jobs, what it'll do to investment. And a lot of people in the western suburbs of Sydney are buying houses in Adelaide and negatively gearing them as rentals because they can't afford to be in that market. So it's a worry because, it's one of the shocks that you talk about. One of the internal shocks we might be facing is banks suddenly going, actually, we don't lend on that anymore. Or you want to refinance it, we don't do that anymore. And I wonder what that's going to do to we all appreciate there are the housing market in Australia is, and particularly in the megacities, is inflated and dangerous. It's a huge bubble. But there's a way of kind of slowly, you know, getting out of the bubble that's not going to be a shock coming from, in my view, the financial services sector. So it's a tough one. It's good to raise because I think a lot of people are worried about what will happen when they come to refinance. A lot of people will be underwater and if they have to go to principal interest. So it's a worry.
We had a question here.
Thank you, Noel. My question is to Nigel. Going on from your comment about directing immigration to regional areas,
yep.
In today's political environment, what are your thoughts on how do you influence the government to actually invest in regional areas?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I wish I absolutely knew the answer. So what we did is, when I got into this role about 6.5 years ago, we were called Business SA, and I said, well, no, we're Business South Australia. So I went out to the regions, and if two men and a dog turned up, I'd turn up. Fortunately, more than that happened, and we built a great relationship with our 11 key regional chambers of commerce. So we brought out our second policy document, Regional Voice, which talks about all of the needs of the South Australian regional economy, which is all I can speak for here. And people forget it's a $30 billion contributor to our economy. And yet people running businesses in regions feel, you know, overtaxed, underloved and, you know, overregulated. And I think the last Labor government, which was difficult for them to get interested because it's very hard to find votes out in the country, was starting to understand the economic impact of supporting them. But you go to a place like the Eyre Peninsula and we talk about a digital economy, well, they can't even get a reliable connection on the internet. So forget study, forget e-commerce. I think you call them out on these kind of incredibly unfair imbalance between a highly metro area, which is Adelaide, because we're one of the most urbanised cities and states in the world, to you know, you look at what happened in Whyalla with Gupta coming in. I think those are the game changers where people see, you know, major players coming into, you know, the upper Spencer Gulf and doing amazing things with energy, amazing things with world supply chains. And to a certain extent, I think governments get dragged along by that. So, you know, we're seeing agribusiness opportunities, we're seeing mining opportunities, manufacturing, that I think will drag governments with them. But I believe for a long time that regional Australia, full stop, has been incredibly overlooked. And we're just incredibly metropolitan focused. And, you know, so many of our, many of the voters are in the broader metro areas. So I wish I had some answers about that, but we've actually got a few breakthroughs here. And I think the fact that we had managed to get a minister for regional, and Tim Whetstone is a guy who's from the Riverland, he understands it and he's, you know, believes in it. So we are getting there, but it's taking time.
So you're suggesting that the problem exists on a state basis,
yeah,
as regional as well as federal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, look, this is a hugely broad area, but I think one of the escapes to the independence is driven by the regional revolt. So, you know, the fact that people are over both major parties and there's an escape to even minor parties and independents who aren't necessarily the most amazing politicians in the world, but it is a protest vote from the regional communities right across Australia saying metropolitan-based politicians don't really give two proverbials about us. And at least the Katter Party and Bob, you know, crazy Bob with his, sorry, he's not crazy, but he's got a great hat. But the Katter parties have an echo of that regional resentment. And I think it's massive out there. You go in northern Queensland, they want to hear you from Brisbane, from Canberra. They really feel disenfranchised. And I believe we'll still see again in the election next year a massive swing towards minority parties because of the real feeling in regional Australia that they are unrepresented. So yeah, it's a very complex area, but that's one of the symptoms.
What question here?
Andrew from Hender. Several times a week I talk to someone considering coming to South Australia.
Yep.
It will take a significant and very significant pay cut to come and work and live here. It strikes me that we always talk about the organisations and the economy, but in fact the decisions that sit around that are actually human beings, often with families and other reasons to be here. So I think we've got to change the whole narrative, and I'm just worried about whether we're actually geared up to say it's not about the businesses and the economies here, it's actually about getting the people here first, which might be an argument for population first.
Yep.
What we're saying is you need both. You've got to actually have both. You've got to have incentive for both to happen at the same time. And you have to be able to articulate the proposition to be here. It's not difficult when you do it, but it has to be like really, really simply put to people. I just wonder whether we're ready for that. We take an almost academic policy view of it, rather than just a normal conversation. And this comes right back to the interviews, as to why the person's thinking about Adelaide in the first place. So I guess my question is there an appetite to change the whole conversation about why the human being will be here in the first place?
Is it right, Jared? Why don't we just take this one?
Yeah.
Yep. So, mate, because you're in recruitment and very good at it, may I say, you know, if I can recommend you, but you must be starting with a job conversation by definition. And to me, that's always been the critical thing. I mean, we can get people to come. I mean, most of the world would love to come and live in Adelaide. I mean, who wouldn't? I'm an adopted, you know, South Australian, so I can say that. But you are starting in the context where there is a job. And there's no question that we've got to give people. I mean, this is an amazing place to be if you've got a job, you've got an income, you can pay a mortgage. And so, you know, it all starts with a job. And look, I think we can fix our skills issue overnight if every expat South Australian who wanted to come home for a job. We don't need anybody. Well, we do. We need some international migration. But you know what I'm saying? It's like was heartbreaking when I used to go to these other cities and you'd get people going, look, we've dated outside our gene pool, we found the love of our life, we've got two kids and all the rest of it, we want to come home. And you're right, they'll take a cut. They'll actually throw away a career, you know, heading up the kind of the greasy pole to live here. But it's got to start with a job, and I think that's why you're having those conversations. But you're right, we need to humanise it. It's not just talking broadly about economic trends. It's about, do we have a job? I spoke to a lady yesterday at Parliament who's one of our export award winners for the category. CMAX, they're a clinical research organisation. They've signed up 50 people since June, employees, and these are technical, you know, lab-type people. They're desperate. They are desperate for skills. We come across organisations, I'm sure you do, Andrew, every day where people are desperate for the right people. They are there. Maybe we've got to be better at communicating that outside of the state. Certainly, we have no problem in convincing anybody internationally to come to Adelaide. You know, people love the place. We've got to get over the stigma. Greatest respect, Derek. I didn't realise that Jared was from Melbourne when I was talking about the underbelly. And I did apologise to him over lunch and said, had I known he's from Melbourne, I would have really worked it, you know. But anyway, the truth is there is a stigma from other cities. I had it. When I came from Perth, you know, they said, you want to go to Adelaide? I said, what? Adelaide? What, place you fly over on the way to somewhere? Adelaide Highway to nowhere. True story. I said those things. We've got to overcome that. We can overcome that with expats and internationals. Let's not waste our time trying to convince people in other Australian cities because they believe that travelling for 2 hours each way is the way life should be. So I'm really optimistic, but I think, Andrew, it does start with a job story.
I might just add to that in our community pulse survey that we undertook earlier in the year, and we had state-based results as well. One of the striking things about South Australia was that people were happier in their work than other states. And that was a much broader kind of issue around career, development, work-life balance, a whole set of issues. So clearly there's some opportunity there to promote those things. Other questions?
So just on that thing, as someone who's emigrated back to Australia and then net interstate migration to here, how do you achieve, policy-wise, how do you achieve that growth without getting that Melbourne underbelly syndrome? I mean, what policy levers can you do so that growth is still a lifestyle, is still a lifestyle aspiration?
Well, if I think about my experience perhaps in Melbourne since I've been there, it's all about planning. And every time that you have, for example, infrastructure being built that is 5 or 10 years too late, the electorate get very unhappy and very grumpy. And you know, I'm living with some of those issues where I live in Melbourne at the present time. We had an issue about 10 years ago in terms of water in Melbourne, and we ended up on that kind of area where we had 3 or 4 projects that were all in the mix in terms of securing Melbourne's water supply. And we went with, you know, something that was quite costly, perhaps ultimately not necessary. So you've got to plan for these things. There's no substitute for planning and thinking ahead and starting to invest in infrastructure early. And I think certainly if you look at some of the international surveys, we also are not particularly good at the quality of our infrastructure and also some of the mechanisms around how we ensure that they're used efficiently. So I think it's infrastructure is a big part of it, and planning. And again, when I talked about continually updating and evaluating plans, that's about looking at the population projections and realising that, you know, what you thought was going to be the case a couple of years ago is no longer the case, and you need to change your whole policy and infrastructure investment approach around that. So having said that, I think there is a positive sense in Melbourne, for example, at the moment that things are being built and things are changing, and that does help people's sentiment, even replacing level train crossings, which has been one of the big achievements of this government, the state government in Melbourne, is something that people will be talking about on the train in the morning. They'll be talking about it at work. Little things matter to people, I think, in big cities. When you know 5 minutes saved on a commute is seeing your children before they go to bed, or having opportunities that you don't have. So I think small things can make a difference.
That's true.
So that's really, I think, what sits at the heart of fixing up cities.
And to be fair, we're not incredibly visionary about infrastructure in South Australia. So I spent the last 6.5 years defending what people called a white elephant, which was our desalination plant. It's one of the finest pieces of engineering. The Spanish tell me, who run it in the world, they run a lot of desal plants, and they say ours is amazing. And I keep on saying, $2 billion, 2.3 or whatever it was. Less than a hospital, by the way, so it was about 2 billion. And you kind of go, only a few months ago, we were using 50% of its capacity. Most people probably don't know that. We were using 50% of the desal plant's capacity to make sure we got water in the state. You know, nobody's going to invest in a place. So it appalls me that, you know, we criticise visionary infrastructure like a desal plant when it's so incredibly important. And I said to SA Water when I did a motivational speech to their staff a few years ago, I said, you'll only be noticed when something goes wrong. You know, when nothing goes wrong, nobody cares. But when something goes wrong, you know, and the ridiculous water main thing here, you know, everybody got insane about a few water mains bursting. And so infrastructure, quite often, the reason it's 10 to 15 years late is nobody's prepared to back it early. And yet when we do back infrastructure early, like the desal plant, which is incredibly important for the driest state and the driest continent in the world, there was all this moaning and bitching about it. And, you know, what was dear yesterday is going to be cheap tomorrow if we have a crisis in water, I can tell you that. So interesting, you're right, infrastructure is absolutely on the mark. And, you know, do we build it and they'll come? You know, to use the old baseball analogy, to a certain extent, I think we do. I'd love to have a fantastic tram system back in the city from the airport, light rail, whatever it might be. It will be transformational. It will be transformational just for our visitor economy, let alone anything else. But you've got to have an enormous vision to do that. I mean, I think back to the Kennett era in Melbourne. You know, he had an enormous vision for infrastructure when you would have said Victoria couldn't have afforded it. So, I mean, governments can borrow money cheaper than anybody else. We'll all be around to pay it off over time. But why not spend it on, you know, infrastructure? And I, Hamilton, you'll have to forgive me, but just on my way out, you know, it's hard to spend money on infrastructure in South Australia when it costs $9.3 billion a year for payroll for the public sector. For those public sector people in the room, I think you know where I'm coming from. I'm not anti-public sector. But when our public sector is the biggest in the country, so we're about 16% FTE. Victoria's about 10.4%. You're the best in the country. Hate saying that, sorry, but there you go. It's very, very hard to find that extra billion or 2 billion when we are spending so much on a state public sector payroll. Those are the facts. And if we don't change that, we're not going to have the visionary infrastructure we need. So that's not me being anti-public sector. It's me being saying, well, let's have an efficient, affordable public sector that reaches any kind of benchmark. So about 12.5% would be a reasonable benchmark. We're at 16. And we can't change that overnight, but unless we actually accept the fact that that extra $1 or $2 billion we're spending every year on a payroll could have been spent on visionary infrastructure, then, you know, that's something we're going to have to live with.
Oh, sorry, one here.
excuse us, a bit of a thought bubble question, but when you're talking about, when you're talking about population growth, and it sounds like it's almost like a company-specific initiative, they've got to go and bring people over for a particular job. Is there any programs, or is there a need for a program, an advertising-based program, like we do with the Tourism Commission, to get tourists here for short stays to actually promote South Australia as a living destination, not just a short stay? And excuse my ignorance, but is there something like that actually around? That we're going to these markets to actually advertise.
Is there Karen?
Sorry. It's a very good question because one of the things we've been talking about, Karen Kent from Study Adelaide, and our role is to promote Adelaide to international students. And one of the things we've been talking about at board level this year is how can we leverage tourists, so international visitors to South Australia, and plant the seed about Adelaide as a future study destination for their children. So how do we, if they're here and they go, wow, this is actually a really lovely city, and there's a couple of big universities on North Terrace, and how do I actually go for a tour at the last minute? So we are looking at how we can potentially facilitate that and make it easier for tourists. So I think it's a good question. I think the work that the Tourism Commission does and Tourism Australia do on a national level actually really benefit a lot of other sectors, such as international education. So I don't know that there's necessarily a need to replicate that, but I think there's a better opportunity we could have to leverage each other's activity. And one of the things that we're also looking at, as well as that, how do we present that opportunity to visitors to the state when the parents are coming here visiting their children? We would love to do things like a state reception for them, you know, to say, thank you for investing in your child's education in South Australia, but how, you know, if you're interested in migration or you're interested in investment or property or whatever it might be, there's people here you can talk to. So I think it's actually being smarter about how we leverage the people already coming rather than investing in really big, expensive advertising campaigns, because I've worked for the Tourism Commission as well for many years, and you know, it's a lot of money to do that. So I think it's actually leveraging what we're already doing better.
Megan, did you want to comment?
Yeah, thank you. Is my voice loud enough? Yeah, okay. Thank you, Karen. And It's not loud enough. I wanted to link, so thank you, Karen, on the back of your comments. I'd like to answer your question by linking the job opportunity discussion with the population growth one. So one of the powerful things we can do to a very targeted audience is to work with international companies who would like to invest in South Australia, who have those fabulous expat South Australians in their networks. They're just in London running a visual effects company in London because there's not a big enough critical mass here, or they're working in a really important cybersecurity network in the US, and they don't have the career development opportunities here. And it's, if we can be clever enough about targeting those international investors who add value to our local ecosystem, not supplant local capacity, but add to the business credit capability here, we've almost got a direct line to those expats who are doing fabulous work internationally. And I can tell you I can give you evidence of international companies that we've attracted to South Australia who have had the most positive response internally to the call that they will be doing something in South Australia. Things like international companies deciding to invest here on the back of which their global networks fill with South Australians saying, great, we can go home. We can all go back. Or Sydney side is saying, excellent, something great to do in Adelaide, and actually I can afford a house there, so I will consider to relocate. So there are moments where the Eastern Seaboard players may be targets. But I think the investment exercise is an interesting one because it taps us in not only to additional economic capability that we can bring to the state with the right opportunity, but that comes with it the network and the ability to draw back the talent that Nigel's been talking about, because South Australians are global, they've been hypermobile, and they will put up their hands for the right job opportunities, and no, they won't just come back for the lifestyle. None of us can afford that. But with the right job entry moment, they will. So I think this is where the international investment discussion joins up with the population growth with that right demographic, which was the other theme that has come out of the presentation today.
Great, thank you.
Hi, it's Valerina from The Advertiser. I was just wondering about whether the issue of participation rates across states in Australia is also an important factor when you're looking at jobs and opportunities and population growth and just getting the internal population to also contribute as much as what you're expecting skilled migrants to bring in. Isn't that an important part of the conversation? And you touched on the jobs being here but not enough people putting their hands up for it, and the issue of ICE in regional South Australia. So I'm just wondering, while the macro issues are being looked at, is there a role for businesses and the state government to play in getting participation levels up?
Certainly, in the report, we've focused on some of the groups that are underrepresented in the workforce. And particularly, I think at a time where you have unemployment coming down and the jobs market overall looking pretty strong, to me it seems to be a good opportunity to really focus on longer term unemployment and getting people back into work. So absolutely, I think participation is as high or higher than it's ever been, the participation rate, but there's still more that we can do. And if you look at some of the underrepresented groups, whether it's people with a disability, Indigenous people, we are underperforming compared to other advanced economies. So there's no doubt that we've still got some capacity to get people into the labour market. Those policy interventions, as I kind of mentioned, they have to be handmade. I don't see the current kind of model around Job Active, for example, a large federal government program is not going to deliver those sorts of outcomes. We need really tailored solutions with a number of sectors coming in to provide those solutions. But you're absolutely right, there is that potential there. It'd be great to see it taken up.
Just very quickly, I do fret about young people in regional South Australia. The drug problems in our regions are very, very bad. The depression problems, the amount of single car accidents, i.e. young guys driving into trees, the boredom, the sense of hopelessness, and so participation, if you've got three guys getting the dole in a cheap house in, Whyalla and watching video games and anything else on the screen and doing drugs, it's an alternative to go to what they see as a shitty job, if I can use that technical term. It's so sad because we're seeing whole generations of young people in the regions. If they stay, it can be pretty awful but then a lot of the better ones leave. So the worst thing we've got is a tradie will say, John was with me for 4 years, I gave my life and soul to him. The day he finished his apprenticeship, he either went to Adelaide and left me, or he went to Queensland or somewhere else, or he put a shingle up 100 metres down the road and he's now competing with me. And these are real problems, and that's the participation issues in places like regional South Australia. I mean, Jared certainly deals with those broader participation issues, but you just drive through these country towns, you just see it, and it's a human tragedy as much as anything else.
All right, we've got to meet Hamilton's KPI, which I think we can do a few minutes. So I'm sure he'll thank me later. Thank you, everyone, for the questions. And I think great that different people were able to contribute in terms of commentary as well. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Together. Thank you.